Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Thursday afternoon. It's starting to get towards summer here in Phoenix, Arizona. And that is inevitable, I suppose. I'm glad that nature is regular. And we're slowly tilting that direction, and it's warming up here in Phoenix. We continue with our examination of some of the claims of Dan Barker in the last program. I sort of finished up really quickly at the end with about a four-minute run through some of the issues that Dan Barker forgets to mention when discussing the subject of John Calvin. But I knew there was a second section of his exchange with Doug Wilson I wanted to play first. Because I think I find it quite interesting. So let's listen to after the opening statements and the rebuttals. Then there was some cross-examination, and here's what Dan Barker had to say later on after that presentation we heard last time about John Calvin.
Doug. Okay, so we heard about John Calvin burning a man to death who committed no crime, who violated no law in that city or in that area, who broke no scriptural law, who simply disagreed with John Calvin's authority. He was burned to death along with his book. So I want to ask you, was John Calvin a good man?
John Calvin was a good man, not a perfect man, not a sinless man, but he was a good man. Yes.
Okay, well, you heard it. A man whose vanity and ego is so offended because someone disagreed with him, publicly burns him at the stake. A truly good man like Michael Servetus, who did exactly what John Calvin himself did by dissenting from the church.
Demas has the right to kill anybody he wants.
Well, I'm not arguing for Demas as a god, by the way. You misconstrued my argument. But
the people of Europe had the right to kill Servetus if they wanted.
So John Calvin, the murderer, was a good man, according to you.
The people of Europe, Lutherans, Roman Catholics, and
it was John Calvin's decision. His vanity was offended.
Okay, let's stop there, because there's just so many errors to address that eventually you start losing track of all of them. I would assume that Dan Barker is reading some bad material on the subject of John Calvin. He's probably reading atheist material. I know, looking at his book, Godless, looking at the section where he attempts to present contradictions, they really do reflect the worst that Prometheus puts out, let's put it that way. And if you aren't going to engage in meaningful biblical exegesis in the assertions of your contradictions, then it's not overly surprising that you would not do much in the way of history. Many people hear about Michael Servetus as the chief argument against John Calvin. I would simply like to suggest to you that if Servetus is an argument for rejecting John Calvin as a good man, then Servetus is an argument for rejecting that almost anyone alive in 1553 was a good man. And what I mean by that is that the governments that existed in Europe in 1553 were absolutely united in their condemnation of Miguel Servetus. In fact, I don't believe that you would find Servetus arguing for freedom of religion. In fact, he was arguing in his Restitutio, the book that came out in January 1553, which was a direct shot at the Institutio, the Institutes of John Calvin, that it was his view that should be adopted. Yes, Calvin, in a sense, laid the seed that would grow into the concept of freedom of religion, but it was not something that had yet come into any type of maturity at all, In fact, you could say its growth had only just begun with the Anabaptists and the Radical Reformation, which at that time was in great disrepute because of what happened at Munster. And so when we think about what happened with Servetus, Barker tries to present it as if this was something that Calvin did. What he does not tell you is twofold. Let's first start with Calvin's sister with Servetus. He describes them as friends. Calvin never described Servetus as his friend, and neither would Servetus have described Calvin as his friend. That's just simply inaccurate. Instead, you have two men who were contemporaries, born within about a year of each other. And yet, both very brilliant. I think Servetus saw in Calvin an intellect equal to his own. Servetus was a brilliant man, but he was not a balanced man at all. He was truly all over the place as far as the things that he studied. He's been credited with describing the circulatory system, though I've never really tracked down exactly where that comes from as to whether that's really accurate or not. But he studied astrology. He studied a wide variety of things at various points in his life. And in fact, just prior to 1553, after an extensive attempted correspondence on his part, it's very interesting, in the middle 1540s, he sent as many as 30 letters to Calvin. Calvin simply refused to talk to him. He reminds me a little bit of somebody who's constantly sending me letters, and I never respond to them either, who is a little bit on the imbalanced side. But Calvin would not respond to him. The man was not a nice person. I don't know where Barker gets this wonderful, truthful, kind man, Michael Servetus. What really needs to be understood is that early on, in shortly after Calvin's conversion, he was prevailed upon to meet with Michael Servetus in an attempt, as Calvin put it, to win him to the Lord. Already Servetus's heresies were well known, even though his books were not nearly as well known as they would be later on. But his heresies were well known, especially on the doctrine of the Trinity. And at that time in Europe, if you were a non-Trinitarian, you were a glowing heretic. And that was considered a crime against the state. That was the case under Rome. That was the case under the Magisterial Reformation. And Calvin risked his life to meet with Michael Servetus, and Servetus never showed. So Calvin risked his life, and Servetus didn't show up. So immediately, if you risked your life to meet with someone to try to talk to them on theological issues, and they never showed up, I don't know about you, but I would probably be somewhat hesitant in the future to really put out a whole lot of effort to communicate with this particular individual. Then, starting around, as I recall, 1545, Servetus, at this time living under the name of Michael Villanueva, because his own name would have had him arrested by the Inquisition, who was personal doctor to the archbishop in a city in France, began corresponding with Calvin. And Calvin immediately knew who it was, even though it was Michael Villanueva. He knew that this was Servetus. And again, Calvin, he approached Calvin, as people always do. We've gotten used to this in our IRC chat channel. People will come in and, "I just have a few questions." Yeah, okay. You have to be careful, because sometimes people do just have a few questions. But in the vast majority of instances where someone's coming in, which we call them a lamer, someone who's actually coming in to just start a fight or try to draw people off or find some disciples for themselves, whatever it might be, they love to come in and, I just have some questions. And of course, what are those questions? They are objections, disguised as questions. And this is how Servetus approached Calvin. Well, Calvin took the time to respond. And Servetus's responses would always be nasty. Calvin even took the time to send him a copy of the Institutes of the Christian Religion, which Servetus sent back with what we might call nasty grams written in the margins. And I wanted to give you an example of some of these nasty grams. Remember, this is 8 years prior to him showing up in Geneva. Here's one of the things that Servetus writes to Calvin during this period of time. I have often told you that that triad of impossible monstrosities that you admit in God is not proved by any scriptures properly understood. Or later on, this shows that your knowledge is ridiculous, say, nay, a magical enchantment and a lying justification, and so on. So much that even Bolsec describes Servetus as a man known for arrogance and insolence. And so, after the first, he also, by the way, sent to Calvin a manuscript of his upcoming book that he was working on, which again is denial of the doctrine of the Trinity and various sundry other issues along with it. And Calvin refused to return it. He in fact, after about the second letter he sent to him, just refused to have anything to do with them at all. He wrote over 30 letters to Calvin, and Calvin just said, not doing anything, not responding to this man in any way, shape, or form. And after that, Servetus basically started focusing upon end times. He was the Harold Camping of his day. he actually came up with a date. Folks, there's been Hal Lindsey was a late comer. Let me assure you, Hal Lindsey was a late comer. In fact, let me again see if I can get you the specific dates here. What was the dates he had come up with? I saw them here just a few moments ago. Somewhere between 15... why can't I find it? I should have marked it, but I didn't want to mark this book up. This is called Dead Air, which is not a good thing to do. This is why Rush, you know, keeps talking at this point in time. It's somewhere between like 1555 and 1585, as I recall, was the time period he came up with. That's when it was all supposed to be wrapped up. So in other words, that was right around the corner. So the Jehovah's Witnesses and everybody else, they're latecomers. People have been doing this for a long, long time. So he really wasn't focused on that kind of thing for a while. But then something happened in 1553. I forgot something here. Remember that Calvin knew where Michael Villanueva was. He knew where Servetus was. He knew the pseudonym he was using. And he could have turned that information over to the Roman Catholics, but he didn't. He could have betrayed him, but he didn't. Not that he liked the man, not that he approved of this heresy or anything along the lines of that, but he didn't. What happened was, a man in Geneva was trying to convert a relative of his, who was a Roman Catholic. And he was aware of the fact, Calvin had mentioned to some of his close friends, that Villanueva, Servetus, was actually living in a Roman Catholic country, and in fact, was in the employ of the archbishop of a major city. And so in a letter, this man said to his Roman Catholic relative, he said, look, in Geneva, we are truly concerned about truth and Christian doctrine, and we would not put up with someone like that infamous heretic, Michael Servetus, who is living in a Roman Catholic country and is in service of an archbishop. Well, his correspondent immediately turned that over to the authorities, who immediately went to Villanueva, and he denied everything. I'm not Michael Servetus. No, that's not me. No, no, no. And so they wrote back to the reformed man in Geneva and said, you've made an accusation here against this man. You need to back it up. And so he went to Calvin. And as he himself said, had to plead with Calvin, had to convince Calvin to give over the documentation that would be needed to demonstrate that Michael Villanueva was actually Michael Servetus. And since there was a legal proceeding ongoing, he felt that that was what he should do. But you'll notice, here's what the man said. But I will tell you one thing. I had the greatest difficulty in getting them out of Monsieur Calvin. Not that he wants such execrable blasphemies to go unreproved, but because it seems to him that his duty as one who does not bear the sword of justice is to convict heresies by doctrine rather than by pursuing them with the sword. But I was so importunate with him, remonstrating that I should be accused of levity unless he helped me, that in the end he agreed to let me have what you see. Well, he sent along portions of Servetus' manuscript and enough information to demonstrate that Michael Villanueva was the one who'd written these letters and was, in fact, Michael Servetus. So that's how he became known to the Inquisition. That's how he was arrested. And while on trial, in his nightshirt, he snuck over the wall while he asked the guard to use the restroom and jumped up on top of the outhouse, in essence, and jumped over the wall and escaped. But he, for some odd reason, made a beeline for Geneva. There's a lot of discussion as to why that was and why that would be. I think he knew that his jig was up and he wanted to take on Calvin. And many speculate that this was one of the most difficult times for Calvin in Geneva. Why? Well, something that Mr. Barker doesn't seem to understand is that John Calvin was not even a citizen of Geneva at this time. He became a citizen in 1559. This is 1553. His book had come out in January, that is, Servetus's, and he knew that in the past few elections, everything had gone against Calvin in Geneva. And so many believe, and there's reason to believe this given how Servetus behaved when he got there, that he thought that the enemies of Calvin would be able to be convinced to side with him against Calvin. And in fact, even once he was arrested in Geneva and put in prison, he demanded that Calvin be put in prison as long as he was prosecuting him. Now remember, the chief minister, since this was a theological issue, would be under obligation to be the prosecutor in this case. But it was not the minister or the ministers who did the arresting or the punishing. When people say that Calvin had Servetus burned, they are misrepresenting the historical situation. They try to present it as if Calvin was this autocrat. He ruled Geneva. That is not the case. Anyone who has read anything about the history of the situation knows that's not the case. So you have the personal history. And then you have the situation at the time of Servetus' arrest. And that is that Calvin is fighting hard to maintain his position. Servetus immediately makes contact with those in the city who are Calvin's enemies. And he attempts to have Calvin arrested on charges of heresy. Years before, a man had accused Calvin of heresy in regards to Arianism and a denial of the deity of Christ. He brought those things back up. He wanted Calvin put on trial and hoped to see him destroyed. In fact, he even filed a motion accusing Calvin of simony, accusing Calvin of doing what he did to gain money, and everybody knew that Calvin was not a man with a love for money, but he still made the accusation, and filed it in such a way that he wanted to receive Calvin's home and property if he prevailed in his suit against Calvin. So this is not a man who's just sitting there, you know, sitting idly by going, oh, I'm just such an innocent person. He, to the end, not only maintained his position, but he fought to have Calvin accused along these lines as well. And so when Barker tries to tell us that Calvin's ego was hurt, it was just a little disagreement, this is absurd. It is absurd beyond the level of absurdity. Because, you see, the Genevans wrote to the other Swiss cantons, and all of the Swiss cantons, without exception, insisted that Servetus had to die by burning. All of them. They wrote to... Now, remember, the Inquisition, after he escaped, burned him in effigy along with a few bales of paper representing his books. So we know what they thought about it. So it was very clear what the Roman Catholics thought about Michael Servetus. All the Swiss cantons said he must die. They wrote to Philip Melanchthon. Philip Melanchthon, Luther's successor, was not like Luther. He was, I think last time I described him as somewhat squishy. And yet Melanchthon wrote back and said it is necessary that Servetus be punished, that he die. This was the united voice of all the governments of Europe. So they try to present it as if as if Calvin was just doing something, and everybody's like, oh, but we can't stop Calvin, and as if this is some unusual thing. If Calvin is to be convicted of something, is to be convicted of living in 1553. He did nothing out of the norm whatsoever in any way, shape, or form. He was not there at the burning, lighting the fires. In fact, the ministers specifically asked that Servetus receive a quicker and less painful execution. And the little council, which is the secular council, which is the council that burned Servetus, the little council refused. They did not allow even for what the ministers asked to take place. And even up until the night before his execution, Calvin went to Servetus and sought to try to convince him of the errors of his ways. And I want to read you some of the things that he said. I brought the wrong book. I apologize. That's not in this one. I can't tell you. But to make a long story short, he sought... This was not a man gloating over the destruction of this person. This is not anything like what Dan Barker and others try to present. Here is a man who, you've got to give Calvin his props, he was consistent. The reason that he opposed Servetus, the reason he prosecuted Servetus, is because he truly believed that his viewpoints were a cancer. And now that he was convicted and was about to be executed, he sought to see him before that happened, repent of his heresies and his errors, and did not receive any indication from him that he did that. And in fact, it was Guillaume Farel, not John Calvin, who accompanied him to the execution. And so it's simply a matter of being balanced. It's simply a matter of allowing the historical facts to speak. It's so easy to use this kind of argumentation against people of the past. I hate to say it, but this is how Dave Hunt acts. Dave Hunt does the exact same thing in regards to the Servetus incident as well. And it is meant to, it's obviously illogical argumentation. Well, if Calvin was a mean, terrible, horrible, nasty man, then Calvinism must be unbiblical. Try to follow the logic on that one for a moment, and eventually you'll explode, because there is no logic to it. But that is the kind of argumentation that you get. And with postmodernists in our day, and especially with the next generation that unfortunately is historically ignorant on a level that is difficult to even begin to comprehend, it works real well. People today are more than willing to anachronistically apply our standards today to people who lived before. And I don't know about you, but I sure hope that people living 50 or 100, 150 years from now will not judge me on the basis of an anachronistic historical methodology. And if you have concerns about things like that, then you would, I think, understand that as well. But that's what people do. And so it's a cheap argument. It's a cheap debating point. You know that in a debate, the other guy's never going to have enough time to actually, fix these things up and give you a context at all. And so that's how you get away with that kind of thing. And so I want to expand out on that a little bit. I went through it very quickly before. But especially if, we talk to a lot of folks on this program. You're attempting to bring reform to your church. You're attempting to encourage people to think biblically, and they discover this name Calvin, and I've not Googled it, but something would tell me that probably on the first page, if you Google John Calvin, you're going to find references to Michael Servetus. And I've mentioned before, the very first time I ever heard about John Calvin and Calvinism was in a Watchtower article about Michael Servetus. And so that kind of stuff is out there. And so you need to know, and you need to have some backgrounds so you have some understanding of what this was all about. Calvin was not running around with a lighted torch in his hand, lighting people up right and left around Geneva just for the fun of it. You can definitely, as a Baptist, I like to go through this story, and then I like to play the movie The Radicals, which gives the other side, in a sense, of what it was like to be persecuted by the magisterial reformers. As a Baptist, the magisterial reformation, which places that power in the hands of the secular authority, is dangerous. And many of my forefathers died through that. And I would disagree with the magisterial reformation. But the fact of the matter is, that's all there was in that day. And I want to look at anybody like a Dave Hunt, who says, well, he should have known better. I want to look him in the eyes and say, you really think that in that day, when Europe had known nothing for centuries prior to this, of quote-unquote religious freedom, that you not only would have seen all the errors of Rome, that your vision is so clear of the Bible without tradition, that you would have gone as far as they did and even farther to a perfectly consistent position? You want to look at me in the eye and tell me you'd do that? And the sad thing is, I think Dave Hunt would. I really think he would. When the man can look at me and say, I have no traditions, then I think he would say, well, of course, I'd just pick up the Bible and read it. And that's how it would go. So, anyway, I wanted to expand out on that a little bit. Before we go to our break, I'm not alone in the studio today. We have a studio audience today. Sitting on the floor behind me is my daughter. Hi, Summer. How are you? She's drinking one of my FRS energy drinks, but that's how things go when you have kids. You know, I bought them for me, but, you know, when the little ones say, hey, I want one of those. Also in the studio with me here. In fact, Brother Jamin, you have a microphone right there in front of you. Why don't you slide that one down towards you there? I think Rich can turn that on, and it's on the side. You don't want to talk right into it. You want to turn it sideways a little bit. Oh, he's right there. Okay, all right. Thanks, Rich. Appreciate that. Havin Channel, a young man I met in 2005.
Long time ago.
Has a picture of me and him at Omaha Bible Church. That's where it was, right?
Yeah.
And he's looking all, you know, and I'm sitting there looking away with my eyes rolled up in the back of my head because before that, how long before that had you come into channel?
Well, I think it was about the end of my first year in high school, I think. So that would be 2004.
Wow.
That's 5 years ago.
Okay, all right.
If I did the math right.
You can actually get a little bit closer,
okay,
there.
Right.
So we knew each other from the chat channel, and then you and Stark and Floggy came down to, I was speaking on, what was I speaking on, justification?
The law thing. Antinomianism.
Antinomianism. Oh,
that's
okay. Man, see, it's when you speak as much as I do, you start losing track of what it was you were talking about. But that's where we first met. And since then, you have now graduated from Dort, D-O-R-D-T. How did you do that, given that you're not Dutch? Do they actually allow that?
That's a good question. They do allow that. And they do allow public school German Baptists to go there.
So really?
That's bizarre.
That is, but you were sort of, but you could never really be on the inside circle.
Well, I tried to push my way in, but it didn't work out.
No, you may like tulips, but you didn't have the right last name. There's no two ways about
that's
that.
Right.
And now you're looking at continuing on with your education with pursuing a master's in Christian thought. And I wanted to mention that about 2 weeks ago, we had a fellow come in to the chat channel, and he asked a question. And that's not unusual in our chat channel. People like to come in, especially when they find out that I'm there. All of a sudden, it's the online Bible Answer Man, and every question I've ever wanted to ask, I'm supposed to just stop everything and do anything. And this fellow said, what's the difference between evidentialism and presuppositionalism? And I said, you know what? I really don't have time for this. So Slam's going to do that. And, of course, your nick is Slam. And I'm not going to tell everybody why that is because it's sort of embarrassing. But
yep.
Anyway, So you evidently wrote some papers on that subject at some point. Because everyone sat back and was sitting there going, now, wait a minute. Either he types at 187 words per minute, or is very good with the cut and paste feature on his computer. One of the two.
It's the latter.
It's the latter. Yeah. But you helped that gentleman out. I think he was probably, by the time it was over with, was like, a couple paragraphs would have been enough.
Just taking after you, James.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is very, very true. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, I did appreciate what you had to say there, and I'd like to think that you're here just because you're just so taken with me. and that's why
am I supposed to argue with you on that?
But I don't get the feeling that that's the whole reason why you came all the way down from South Dakota. I don't know. Maybe no. The scary thing is that I tried to warn my daughter about this guy, but they met in channel, and for some reason they've been spending time together. I'm not sure why that is. So Yes, indeed. So, so we have our studio audience here today, and I went a little bit past my break time. But poor Summer's going to have to go to work, but Jamin's going to stick around. And feel free, I'm going to be playing some Dan Barker here, so maybe you'll have some commentary you'd like to offer there, too. But we're going to take our break and be back with a little more Dan Barker. And, hey, your phone calls, too, 877-753-3341. We'll be right back.
BibleWorks 8 is here. Full of innovative and essential tools, users will have 190-plus Bible translations, 35 original language text and morphology databases, 29 lexical grammatical references, and an abundance of additional resources. Pastors, you will appreciate the phrase matching tool, which will allow you to find all of the verses containing phrases similar to your search verse, giving you greater depth and keener insight during sermon preparation. Seminary professors and students will be enriched by the way BibleWorks 8 shows the most common words in the pericope, book, or chapter, plus provides a wider range of formatting options and faster access to copying preferences. Scholars, your research just got easier with the ERMI, External Resources Manager, a handy tool to collect, organize, and display resource files from your computer as well as the internet. Dr. James White says, BibleWorks is the best Bible software available. I have used BibleWorks software for years, and each new release has brought many new and useful tools to the program. This is the program that runs 24/7 on my office computer, and it is the one that's running on my laptop when I engage in debates. It is simply the number one research tool for anyone doing serious exegesis of the text. For over 15 years, BibleWorks has assisted all users in their study of the original languages, and that enables you to do one thing, focus on the text. And that translates to focusing on the truth. Order your copy of BibleWorks at aomen.org, and for a limited time, you'll receive free shipping and a free MP3 download of the White Airman Debate.
The Trinity is a basic teaching of the Christian faith. It defines God's essence and describes how He relates to us. James White's book, The Forgotten Trinity, is a concise, understandable explanation of what the Trinity is and why it matters. It refutes cultic distortions of God, as well as showing how a grasp of this significant teaching leads to renewed worship and deeper understanding of what it means to be a Christian. And amid today's emphasis on the renewing work of the Holy Spirit, The Forgotten Trinity is a balanced look at all three persons of the Trinity. Dr. John MacArthur, senior pastor of Grace Community Church, says, James White's lucid presentation will help layperson and pastor alike. Highly recommended. You can order The Forgotten Trinity by going to our website at aomen.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Rich Pierce. In a day and age where the gospel is being twisted into a man-centered self-help program, the need for a no-nonsense presentation of the gospel has never been greater. I am convinced that a great many go to church every Sunday, yet they have never been confronted with their sin. Alpha and Omega Ministries is dedicated to presenting the gospel in a clear and concise manner, making no excuses. Man is sinful and God is holy. That sinful man is in need of a perfect Savior, and Jesus Christ is that perfect Savior. We are to come before the holy God with an empty hand of faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Alpha and Omega takes that message to every group that we deal with, while equipping the body of Christ as well. Support Alpha and Omega Ministries and help us to reach even more with the pure message of God's glorious grace. Thank you.
It is a historic day here on the Divine Line. Not only do we have a studio audience, but we have different bumper music. That one didn't start out too well. We might have to work on that one. But
everybody's a critic.
Everybody's a critic. Yes, everyone is a critic. That is how it works. There's no ways. Anyhow, since we have a phone caller all the way from the United Kingdom, it's a good opportunity for me to get to speak to my fellow. So let's go ahead and talk to Daniel over in England. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Dr. White. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you fine. How come you don't have a really good British accent?
Well, I was going to say, I'm not going to try to match you on that. I'm going to grad school here in England.
Yeah, so you're just a plain old Yank, in other words. So
I've not acquired the accent yet, and I don't know if I shall. But
That's a shame. Well, you got to realize, if you're going to graduate school over there, when you come back, if you have an English accent, people will think you're smarter than you actually are. So you need to pick it up. I mean, look at Christopher Hitchens, for crying out loud. Look at the stuff he gets away with, and the whole reason he gets away with it is because he's got an English accent. He says stuff that's just dumb, but when you say it with an English accent, then it sounds much more smarter than when we say it, and we just sound like, well, anyway.
That is a good point.
Anyway, go ahead with your question, sir.
Yeah, it concerns arguing on the basis of probabilities. This came up in your commentary last week on the D'Souza and Barker Q&A session. And it's a thing that I've heard you mention a number of times on the Dividing Line. But as far as being something sub-biblical about arguing for God's existence or, say, for the resurrection, on the mere preponderance of probabilities, as you put it. And I was wondering if you could clarify what exactly is so biblical about it, and maybe what is not. I know you've appealed to the apostolic example, and said, this isn't how the apostles argued. But so I guess I was wondering if you could clarify on that issue, and whether you think, say, all forms of evidential argumentation that would appeal to probabilities are unbiblical, or whether it's, say, a certain kind that appeals to a certain Arminian, view of man and of the natural man.
Well, there's a number of things there. I think that any argumentation that encourages the rebel sinner in his rebellion and encourages that individual to think that he is in a position to judge God and to judge whether there's a greater probability or possibility or whatever of God's existence, I think that's going to be unbiblical right from the start. I see no evidence whatsoever that the apostles argued in this way. Now, some people would immediately say, well, the apostles didn't live in a postmodern world and we have to adapt. I think that would probably be the primary argumentation that is presented to us. And so part of this discussion is, where do we derive our methodology? And there are going to be many people who would say apostolic example is not where we derive our methodology. We have a core of Christian beliefs, and as societies change, that core becomes expressed in different ways as long as the core doesn't change. So there would be some people who would go there. They would make that kind of argumentation. I would not. Secondly, I would say that there is a fundamental difference here in the approach that one makes both philosophically and apologetically. And that is that, and it does go back to a view of both God and man. If you, again, are allowing a person to stand in judgment over God's proclamation of his own existence, then your entire epistemology is not going to be a biblical epistemology. It's not an epistemology that starts with God and then radiates out from God. If you could picture this, and when I teach my classes, I draw this on the board. But if you could picture this, the epistemology or the worldview of those who would say, that would in essence encourage you to consider the greater probability of the existence of a God. What has a God now become? A God has become an object of your knowledge. You are in the center of the diagram, and you are now reasoning out from you to God, to love, to concepts, to facts, to science, but you are the one who is the center of that diagram. I would submit to you that a biblical epistemology has God in the center. I am outside of that, and a proper epistemological knowledge of the world around me, concepts, whatever it might be, has the line going from me to the center, to God, and from God to any object of knowledge, because God is the one who defines anything that is. I believe that that is the radical epistemology of the New Testament. Why do I say that? Because the New Testament says that all things are created by Him and for Him, that Jesus Christ is the creator of all things, whether visible, invisible, principalities, powers, dominions, authorities, all things created by Him and for Him. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. If that is true, then anything that exists is what it is because God has made it that way. And any fact is a fact because God has made that fact to be that fact. And so, from my perspective, using a defective epistemology and a defective worldview to try to slowly nudge someone toward the proper worldview is itself a compromise. And it's unnecessary. It's unnecessary because it comes from a theology that thinks that it's my job to convince somebody to adopt my position rather than the Spirit of God's job to bring about regeneration. So there is a fundamental difference along those lines as well. And so, yes, when I hear William Lane Craig and the people in the Craig camp arguing that the preponderance of the evidence, and notice that just means the majority of the evidence points to the greater probability of the existence of a God, I say that is a sub-Christian approach. I do not see how that in any way, shape, or form can... I do not see the bridge that you can build from there to Christian theism and a biblical theism. The bridge between those two spots is going to have to involve, at some point, turning around and blowing up the epistemology you use to get them to that point. And I don't see how God is glorified in that. I really don't. And I don't see how people actually function within that. And so, again, I'm forced to this, not because I don't see that it's, to be perfectly honest with you, an easier argument. You're presenting a smaller target for your opponent. And I think it's one of the functionally... It's a means type situation. The ends justify the means. I really think that one of the reasons that people go there is that it presents a smaller target to be shot at by your opponent. And you can always tell the folks, I lost my caller, didn't I? Oh, bummer. Well, he's listening on the internet, so hopefully he'll continue on. So, Daniel, you can always tell the folks who adopt this kind of perspective, because they will start off a discussion on anything, the existence of God, the resurrection, whatever else it might be, by saying, now, I'm just acting as a historian here. So we don't have to worry about inerrancy. It's just the core of these historical truths that we have to worry about. Well, you know what? Even the atheists see through that one. And I don't have it queued up here. I could get it probably quickly enough, but... the Christopher Hitchens debate with Frank Turek. Hitchens, even though he looked particularly enamored with the fruit of the vine that evening, shall we say, even Hitchens in that state saw so clearly that Turek's arguments were for deism, and then he made this flying leap all the way over to Christian theism when he made his application. And Hitchens could see that he had not built the proper bridge between those two perspectives and caught him on that. And I think a lot of sharp atheists catch people on that. And from my perspective, look, Christianity is a whole thing. I cannot compromise one part of it in hopes of getting you to accept this part of it. Part of that is just simply because I think it's impossible. Part of it's also my theology that I don't have to do that. It's the Holy Spirit of God that brings a person to regeneration. It's the Holy Spirit of God that opens a heart and a mind. That's why I love so much Luke 24:45, where after the resurrection, what does Jesus do when he meets with the disciples? He opened their understanding, their minds. He made them understand the scriptures. There is a spiritual aspect to this. And, you know, the atheist who says, that's just terrible. You're saying that God has to sort of change my brain. Rebellion, what does Paul say in Romans chapter 1? What does rebellion, a twisting the creator-creation relationship, do? When it says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Don't misunderstand what the word fool means there. It means one lacking understanding. There is an epistemological ramification of rebellion against your creator. If your creator, if God created this universe so that his centrality is meant to give meaning to everything else, and you are spending your every moment trying to deny that and suppress that, then yes, that ends up twisting you. That ends up changing the way that you think. It touches the mind. Yes, total depravity touches all of mankind. I saw you agreeing with me over there.
Yes, I did.
You have obviously read some Van Til and these others, and it's hard for me to communicate to folks, but in your context, in fact, did you not do a debate last year?
On apologetic methodology. Yeah, it was four or five months ago, yeah.
And give me some background, because I've forgotten what the other positions were.
Yeah, it was with a couple of friends. One was a Kierkegaardian, and Kierkegaard, of course, said that something that you defend isn't really worth defending. You know, there is no point of apologetics. And then another was kind of a half-hearted Kuyper position. Abraham Kuyper is a neo-Calvinist of the 20th century, and he was one of Van Til's biggest influences. And then my own was just arguing not that necessarily presuppositional apologetics was the best, but that there is a place for apologetics in the Christian faith.
Right.
So that was a pretty basic debate.
So there wasn't an evidentialist in the group?
There really wasn't, and I was basically one of the only ones in the room who thought that apologetics is a good thing. And it's the reason for that is because my particular college is one of the only two which is based off of Abraham Kuyper's specific neo-Calvinist worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And Kuyper in particular was very, like Karl Barth, like Kierkegaard, like all of those thinkers around that time, were very pessimistic of mm-hmm. apologetics. And so that really carried over for, I mean, the next 50 years and in the next 100 years. And so a lot of the people at my college just didn't see the point of apologetics at all.
So now, I don't want to get you in trouble, but this is a reformed institution. And it's a reformed institution of higher learning. How can you not engage, given our culture, in apologetics? I'm sort of missing something.
Yeah, it is a bit. It's a bit ironic because, you know, engaging the culture is actually what Abraham Kuyper and a lot of the reformers was all about. And somehow the apologetic element kind of slipped out. And
Interesting, yeah. Interesting. Well, it would seem to me that anyone today in a university setting, Christian or non-Christian, one of the things that scares me is that people go to a Christian university and they let their guard down. They don't think there's a need for apologetics. They don't. They think since I'm going to a Christian place, I don't have to critically examine what's being said to me. And the result is just such massive confusion.
The reason it's so it's so difficult is because now you're dealing with people who are under the umbrella of religious or Christian, you know. So you think we're all on the same side, right?
Right, exactly.
But then your discernment level has to go up 10 times because now you're dealing with people in the faith. So.
That's right. That's quite true, and that's been my experience as well. Hey, we've got a call here, and let's go ahead and take it while we still have some time here. Let's talk with Tim in Texas. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Dr. White.
How you doing?
I'm quite good. Thanks. So I'm calling because I'm going to be speaking to my church's college group on the reliability of the New Testament next week.
Uh-huh.
Yes, putting to use much of the vast amounts that I've been listening to from you. And so I've only got about 20 to 30 minutes to speak on the subject.
Isn't that fun?
And to refer to more resources, which...
Yes.
will include a lot, but so I'm trying to narrow down to the key concepts to include, and I've got some ideas about that, but I love to get your advice on what you would see as the most important, both like pieces of background to include, and then also the most important like sentences or phrases that like Bart Ehrman will throw out mm-hmm. that require context.
Wow. and do it in 20 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
See, what you have to, let me just mention a couple of things. You know the people that are part of your college and career group, okay? So you know where they're going, you know what their background is, and so you have to make some decisions based upon that. It's always good to have a hook, a way of getting their attention, and they're going to get hit no matter where they are. They're going to get hit with the 400,000 variance number.
Mm-hmm.
So my idea would be use it and explain it before somebody else uses it and abuses it.
Yeah.
If it's sort of an inoculation with truth. So mm-hmm. if you can start off by saying that even conservative biblical scholars will recognize that there would be approximately 400,000 variants in the text of the New Testament. And make sure they understand you're talking about the New Testament here, not the Old Testament.
Yeah.
People frequently get confused. In the number of manuscripts that we have, that gets their attention. And then from that, do you happen to have the DVD of the Ehrman debate?
Not the DVD, the MP3.
Well, you know, the DVD has this beautiful presentation right there in it that gives you all this neat information. The folks at American Vision took my keynote presentation and they made it a part of the DVD, so it's right there. It's really easy to see. But
was that included in the download? Any of for the MP3?
There was a little AVI file that I provided, but that has the same information too. But this is much easier to see and to grab and use and stuff. It's in the DVD, but you can use that. And you can help them to understand, out of these 400,000, you're talking about 5,752 manuscripts, and start breaking it down as to how many that includes per page and so on and so forth, and demonstrate that big number when it's thrown out to them, if no one gives context to it, then their red lights should turn on, and someone's probably trying to deceive them. That would probably be the first thing that I would do. And then the main thing that I would attempt to communicate to anybody if I only had that amount of time would be the concept of tenacity. If you can communicate to them the reality of the fact that in that manuscript tradition, you have the original readings, that even if there is a place where you have two or three possibilities, the reason that scholars press forward and the reason that a believing person can find solace in this and it's important is that one of those two or three readings is the original. So the originals are there. I think that the illustration I used in the debate, which I stole from somebody else, is very, very good. It's like having a 1,000-piece puzzle and you have 1,010 pieces. It's the 10 extra that you have to identify. It's not like you have only 900 of the 1,000 pieces left. That kind of illustration, I think, can help people to understand what the real issues are. And what you might want to do, this would be another way, would a number of the students there probably be carrying an NIV?
I think so.
Okay. What you could do to get their attention at the start, to draw their attention to the issue, would be to ask someone who has, does anyone here have a King James or a New King James? And have somebody identify. Okay. Could you read for me from the Gospel of John, chapter 5, verse 4? And then I'm going to ask someone who has an NIV to read the same text. And then you have the person with the King James and New King James read John 5, 4. And then say, anybody with an NIV, could you read that for me? And you're going to start seeing these amazed looks on the part of everybody in the audience, because there is no John 5:4 in the NIV. It goes from 5:3 to 5:5. Now, there is a note at the bottom of the page, but it's in about 4-point font, and if I don't have my reading glasses, I won't even find it anymore, but most people don't look down at the bottom of the page anyways.
Yeah.
So that introduces them to, have you ever noticed these little notes? You know, it's in the margin of your ESV, it's at the bottom of the page in NASB, however it's typeset, whatever. Have you ever noticed these little notes? Some manuscripts say this and some manuscripts say that. Has that ever bothered you? Let's talk about it. Let's be aware of what this really is, because if we don't talk about it, then other people can come along and use this in a negative way without giving you all the facts. And then once you've whetted their appetite, saying, "Now here's some of the places you can go to get more information."
Now I'll make sure to bring my own NIV just in case.
Boy, the NIV must be hurting these days if we have to drag one along.
We'll see. As far as tenacity goes, I had on my list of things to hit heavily, multifocality, as you've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
For establishing.
The only problem, again, the only reason I didn't mention that is because you've said you've got 20 minutes. And unless you have a graphic like I used, and believe me, it took me a while to develop it. If you this subject is one of the best subjects that I know of that illustrates the glory of the digital projector. Because without being able to illustrate some of this stuff, the blank stares you start getting are really, really, really noticeable. And so I have this really cool graphic. For a certain amount, I could probably be convinced to send it to you.
Have a rush delivery in your store?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Rich about that. But my little box here on my
rush
screen.
Rush right over.
So they have the little box on my screen that tells me that you're one of the channel rats. I actually can probably get that to you a whole lot, at least that part of it, that illustration, that section where I use a map to illustrate the movement of manuscripts around the ancient world.
Okay.
That really helps out a lot.
That would be great.
We can try to figure that out.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Everybody's going to be rushing into the chat channel. I'll take it too! I'll take it too!
All right. Part of why I was thinking multifocality would be good is I wanted to get the idea of the early uncontrolled widespread distribution where no one had control over it.
Right.
To have the power to.
Oh, it's vital. Vitally important.
Changes.
Vitally important. If you can do it in 20 minutes, vitally important. Now, my opening statement, I forget how long were the opening statements in that debate? 20?
15? I don't know.
30 minutes.
They were 30 minutes, My opening statement was 30 minutes. So, that's a little bit longer than you've got, but I covered a little bit more information. So it's possible you might be able to sneak that in, but it can create information overload really quickly with people who don't, if they don't have any background before. So, but remind me in channel, I'll see if I can pull out of my Ehrman debate presentation that particular set of graphics where the manuscripts move around and stuff like that. That would probably be of some assistance along those lines. Okay?
I'll have to do that later tonight. I'm at I'm missing dinner at my church small group right now. So,
well, I appreciate the sacrifice you gave. Thanks for calling today, brother.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. God bless. All right. Well, Jamin, thank you for sitting in today and joining us on the program. And I'm still going to have to put some thought into figuring out just why you are here in Phoenix. I haven't...
Think a little harder.
I appreciate that. All right. Next week, only one dividing line, but we're going to do our best. We can't guarantee anything. We're going to do our best to try to live stream the Dan Barker debate on Thursday night. We're going to try. Don't get mad if we can't do it, but we're going to do our best, so we'll see what happens there. Otherwise, we will see you on Tuesday. See you then. God bless. Thank you.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.